What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends, Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff, in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world, not forgetting current events that occur, plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah, Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know, the lawyers in the house.
Welcome in Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside are in studio. Sam Panionovich here. It is the Walk of Fame Day, so I am dressed better than usual, as Rich, you eloquently pointed out early on.
In the day. Dolled up today, Sam. Very impressive.
Got a haircut.
Looking great.
You got the smart glasses on.
Same shoes.
Yeah.
Same socks.
Fresh socks.
So we've got some in-studio guests. We'll get to Inside Out later on, and then the grab bag, which we always end every show with. But we've got some special guests in from Chicago Legal Prep. Sam Finkelstein is here, and we played at a basketball tournament over at one of your tournament. I guess it was on the west side at... What was the arena, the event?
It was Quest Multisport.
And you've got some friends in studio with you. You want to introduce them for us?
Absolutely. I have Katie Jo Ramirez, who's one of our excellent teachers at Legal Prep, and then Jamarcus Walker, who is about to graduate from Legal Prep in our first senior class.
Amazing news. I mean, I've known Sam and Rather, co-founders of Legal Prep Charter Academy, for years. Very proud to serve on the advisory board of the school. Why don't you tell us, Sam, a little bit about the history of the school, why you started it, and what kind of things you're doing on the west side of Chicago?
Absolutely. So Rather and I were working together at another nonprofit, doing some after-school and summer programs for diverse students interested in the law. And what we found was that the basic skills were just not there. And so we wanted to take the law and infuse it, but do that into a college prep high school that would really prepare students for the rigors they were going to experience at college. So we started the project back in 2009, opened our doors in 2012, and we had a wonderful first class with students like Jamarcus, who joined us for that first class, joined us on the journey, and now we're about to see them off to college.
Amazing. Tell us about what the school makeup looks like, where your students are coming from, that kind of thing.
Sure. So we are located in West Garfield Park, just west of the downtown area. And, you know, our students represent the demographics of that particular community. We have 98% of our students are African American. Over 90% are low income, as defined by eligibility for free or reduced lunch. So we serve a population that does have high need. But, you know, the students have tons of potential and are just outstanding.
And this is a free school?
It is. So we are a public school. We are a Chicago public school operated by a nonprofit. We are a charter school, but we are a public school.
Are there other legal themed schools? We know you're the only one in our state. Are there other schools like this around the country?
There are. There are other schools that are legal themed. There's one in Washington, D.C., and there's a couple in other areas. We do a little bit differently, though. We do really integrate into the school day and, in addition, into programs after school. So I'd say we do it a little bit differently than some of the other models.
Katie Jo, what brought you to Legal Prep, and what do you teach there?
Well, I teach law and literature as well as sophomore English. I came into Legal Prep just really hungry to make a difference, especially in West Garfield Park. What's kept me there are the students. They're incredible, and the parents are incredible. But it is a really, really unique opportunity to create a knowledge base about law in a community that generally doesn't view the law on its side. So having the ability to empower residents of West Garfield Park is really powerful.
Hey, Jamarcus, how long have you been at Legal Prep Charter?
I've been there all 4 years. I started in 2012, and I'll be walking the stage June 4th.
Congratulations. What do you have planned for after high school graduation?
Well, over the summer, probably spend time with friends and family as I get ready to go off to the University of Indianapolis in the fall.
Great. I'm going to put you on the spot with a question. This is a tough one, all right? Tell us what's so good about Legal Prep Charter compared to the school that you went to prior to your freshman year there.
Well, it was the people. When I came in, I didn't know anybody outside of my cousin by default, and now I'm friends with all of my entire class. The staff is amazing. I've built great relationships with board members and partners and so many people that have supported the school. So that's probably one of the greatest things about legal prep.
How much does that help you going forward, not only through college and you're going to be a Greyhound in Indianapolis, but going through life and having to meet new people already at such a young age, and then you're going to do it over and over again? To have that early on in your life, what does that mean?
Well, it showed me that everybody has a story, so that, like, I'm not one of those people who like to rush into, like, meeting people. So, like, I'm a very friendly person. So as I meet people and as I come into, like, contact with people, learn more about them, and I'm more engaged than other people would be about someone they've never met before.
Jamarcus, did you find the legal part of the curriculum challenging? How did you find that first coming into the school? I assume you didn't have much legal training before that. How did you find that part of the course load at Legal Prep?
So it was an addition to it, and it was kind of like confusing when I talked to like a lot of my other friends who are going to like regular high schools.
Sorry, Jason's still confused by a lot of the legal stuff. So
I have a law degree, and I'm still confused by it. So
yeah, when I started, I wanted to be a lawyer my freshman year, and as I went to legal prep and I saw all the paperwork.
Did you want to be a lawyer going into your freshman year, or only after you started you realized that you might, you know, be interested in this as a career?
It was going into my freshman year. After my freshman year, I didn't want to be a lawyer again.
That's the feeling a lot of us have,
law school.
All right, so then how was that reinforced? How did you, you know, as you went forward through your 4 years there, did you feel like law is something you wanted to pursue, or were there, you know, some other thoughts that you had?
There is an addition to law, like communication and probably corporate press that I would do. The legal profession wasn't, like, something that I'm interested into now. I have a lot of friends who are. It was just that I didn't want the paperwork low, and it seemed like a lot of time that could be best used serving elsewhere. So,
Sam, tell us about what kind of practical training, in addition to school classroom activities, your students receive in the legal community here in Chicago.
Yeah, we do a lot of that with the legal community, and I would say one of our hallmark programs is our negotiations program that we do with our freshmen, where we teach them interest-based negotiation skills. They go out to law firms and corporate legal departments across the city and do simulated negotiations, and I think those are real-world skills, whether you're going to be a lawyer or whether you're going to go into business or do something else. It's a real value add for our kids to have that sort of experience. We also have programs where our students learn sort of, we have a lot, we call our logic games program, but it's really about critical reasoning, analytical thinking that we have students do with lawyers as they move up, them progress through their time at Legal Prep.
Katie Jo, I know a lot of the students come into Legal Prep maybe a little bit behind their peers in terms of their levels of reading and writing and some other core skills. How did you deal with that as a teacher?
Well, I think that you kind of have to steal another educator's words, teach like your hair's on fire. So you have to take them where they're at and then just really motivate them to work harder than they've ever thought they could. So differentiation is a huge key to that. A lot of the students come in at a fourth grade level. That's our average reading level. But we do have students that come in as low as second grade. So giving them a variety of reading texts and then making sure that those are high interest texts that can really motivate them to read outside of the class. And you can make up those gains pretty efficiently if you have a motivated teacher and if you have a motivated student base, which we have great teachers and great students. So we've been able to make really, really wonderful gains.
Jamarcus, how many of your friends that you're graduating with, in the graduating class, I think about 90 people, how many of those friends do you think will ultimately be a lawyer if you had to sort of predict the future for... Let's see, 7 years from now.
We don't accept 90 either.
Oh, yeah, 90 is not. None. I'll give you 10. There's a talk that a couple of my closest friends want to do something in the legal profession, and I've heard a lot of them talking about going straight to law school after undergrad, and they've gotten a lot of motivation from some of our teachers who have went on to law school and that are going on to law school in the fall. So, yeah, about 10.
And so to that point, Sam, being a lawyer is not the only thing you can do with a legal prep degree and ultimately a law school degree. That's something that you're focusing on as well, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I think what we're focused on is lawyerly skills. And, you know, we do want kids to go on to be lawyers if they find that interest. But I think, like Jamarcus found, I think it's equally valuable to find out that's not what you want to do and take a different direction before you invest the time and the money into law school. So we want people to make really good, informed decisions.
And so to that point, have you had any, you know, maybe pushback about, does the world really need more lawyers? We've covered that subject here on Legal Face Up before. I think there's 45,000 maybe nationwide new attorneys added every year. So are you doing the world any good by teaching people to become or to be more lawyer, add more lawyers to the world?
I think that I hear that a lot. To answer your first question, that is a frequent thing. But I think the thing that we're doing, which is unique, is we're encouraging diverse students to head towards the legal profession. And while maybe there are too many lawyers or maybe too many new lawyers, what there are not is too many diverse lawyers. And so we are hoping that we can be part of the solution, even if it is an additional 10, 15, 20 every year that come from legal prep that have that interest, that we can start to increase the pipeline of diverse students that are headed to the legal profession.
Jamarcus, you've got two really proud people to your left. What does it mean to be the first chapter of Chicago Legal Prep? I mean, that's going to be your name on that line forever, no matter what happens.
So, yeah, talking to a lot of my friends and the staff at Legal Prep and a lot of my family, there's a great gap that we stepped up to coming in at a new school where there wasn't like someone to show us the ropes of high school. And we've done a great job at it. There are things that we could have done better as students at Legal Prep, but we've set a high standard for the school and for the expectation of the following classes to come. And that's one of the one things that I'm proud of.
Jamarcus Walker is going to the University of Indianapolis. He's going to be a Greyhound, hopefully play baseball. Thank you for coming in. Katie Jo Ramirez, a teacher at Chicago Legal Prep, and Sam Finkelstein, who's pretty much in charge over there.
Just want to add one more thing before we sign off. Sam, just tell us about the amount of your seniors, the percentage that are going to college. I know that's a really huge stat for us.
Absolutely. It's definitely a point of pride for us, especially in our first year with seniors. We do have 100% of our students who are accepted to college. And at this point, 92% are planning to attend in the fall, which is just amazing. We're so, so proud of our seniors.
Amazing. Well, great job, guys. We're really...
Thank you all for coming in.
Amazing stuff.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
And we welcome you back to Legal Face-Off on WGN+. We will have the legal grab bag after this, but we go back to the phones. Dr. Benjamin Chaffee, who is from the University of California, San Francisco School of Dentistry, a dentist by trade, an author, the book Smokeless Tobacco and Sport and Use Among Adolescents, and pretty much the expert on smokeless tobacco. He joins us now in Chicago. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Doctor, thanks for joining us. So in the news this past week was Tony Gwynn's family filed a wrongful death lawsuit on Monday in San Diego in Superior Court against Altria Group, which was formerly known as Philip Morris, several other defendants. And the estate, the family of Tony Gwynn, who's, you know, we all know one of the best baseball players who ever lived, is alleging that Tony Gwynn began to use smokeless tobacco, DIP, commonly known as, at San Diego State University when he was there in the late 70s, and where he later coached after spending 20 years with the Padres. The allegation is that he used 1.5 to 2 cans of smokeless tobacco, usually Skoal, per day, which was the equivalent, according to the lawsuit, of 4 to 5 packs of cigarettes every day for 31 years. His family is alleging that Gwynn, while he was a student at San Diego State, was the victim of a scheme by the tobacco company to get him, who was at that time a fairly prominent rising athlete, to get him addicted to smokeless tobacco while knowing that this posed a danger to him. And specifically, it says that there was a determined effort at the time to market its products to African Americans and that Tony Gwynn was a marketing dream come true for defendants. So we have you on because, as Sam mentioned, you are an expert in smokeless tobacco. Tell us what your 2015 study revealed about the smokeless tobacco industry as it relates to students in general and athletes specifically.
Sure. So a few of the things we looked at were the way smokeless tobacco companies marketed a product, angled their product to intertwine smokeless tobacco as part of the sporting culture. And certainly athletes were using smokeless tobacco for decades before these marketing campaigns came around. But at about the time Tony Gwynn was coming up and others like him, players coming through the college system and the minor league systems in the 1970s, cigarette smoking among athletes was declining substantially. It wasn't uncommon in the 1950s and 60s to see professional baseball players in cigarette ads and smoking cigarettes. And as that cut down, at about the exact same time in the 1970s, we see a real push from the smokeless tobacco industry to get their products into clubhouses at the college level, at the minor league level, at the majors, giving out free samples, picking up endorsements from star players, and creating a marketing campaign that really tied their products to youthful, attractive athletes, outdoor-oriented activities, and baseball was part of that.
How did they? I remember as a child in the 80s watching baseball, and you always see the players, especially then, they were chewing and spitting at the plate. How did the tobacco companies get so entrenched into the baseball culture?
Well, one part of it was some really clever marketing and finding a target that would be receptive to their product. What we see when we talk to young people is a lot of role modeling, looking at revered athletes, older players, star players, coaches, and wanting to be part of that team. Young players that would never touch tobacco as a youth athlete, as a high school athlete, would come to college, come to the minor leagues, and suddenly start chewing. It really became part of a baseball thing, and that was very attractive and very profitable to the companies who made these products.
I mean, I remember Big League Chew. I loved Big League Chew. Still around.
Bubble gum. Throw in your mouth.
Right,
yeah.
But Big League Chew was a pack of bubble gum that was shaped just like a pack
shredded.
Of chewing tobacco.
It was shredded.
It was shredded. You would pull it apart, and it was bubble gum. It was red bubble gum. But can be argued that that was a way of marketing to kids, even younger than the ones you're talking about, to start a lifetime of chewing tobacco. Did you cover that kind of thing at all in your study?
So we didn't look specifically at Big League Chew, but that's absolutely the kind of thing that gets a young person thinking that smokeless tobacco and baseball go hand in hand. And that perception has been around for a long time, and it's still something you see when you go out and talk to young people today.
So as a defense attorney, I'll give you the flip side. And we realize, Doctor, that you're not here as a legal expert. You're not here to really give, legal advice, obviously, nor are we. But I defend these kind of lawsuits all the time. And, if I was defending this lawsuit, I would say that Tony Gwynn was aware of the risks of chewing tobacco. There's no way that you could use two cans of chewing tobacco a day for the amount of time that he did and not be aware of it. And by the way, if he wasn't aware of it, there was a big label, a warning label on the can that said how dangerous it was. So I'm not sure if your study covered that aspect of it, but obviously Altria and the defendants are going to come out strongly and argue that Tony Gwynn had the ability to stop. And while chewing tobacco is addictive, perhaps, this was his choice and ultimately his responsibility.
So a couple of points to that. And again, thank you. I'm not an attorney, so I don't know what legal strategy Tony Gwynn's team may take on this. But there's a number of things we see when we go and we talk to young people and users of products. And this isn't just tobacco. This is human nature in general. Estimating risk is something that we don't do very well. And there was a real push to promote smokeless tobacco as a lower risk, less harmful alternative to cigarettes. And when you go out and you talk to young people and they hear less dangerous, the interpretation often becomes not dangerous at all. And when we see young people, they say, yeah, I see the warning label. I know smokeless tobacco is not good for your jaw. You could lose your teeth. But that's not going to happen to me. I'll quit long before that ever happens to me. And that underestimation of how dangerous this product is widespread, and that inability to communicate what your risk level truly is to the user is something that I think the industry, where a legal team may go after the industry.
And where your study, I think, touched on this, where is it at right now as far as high school baseball players? Are they still using smokeless tobacco, or is that decreased or increased over the years?
So we go out and we work with baseball athletes here in California and at the high school level. And unfortunately, we see use that's much higher than the national average among high schoolers when you go and you look with baseball players. And it's not just baseball. I mean, previous studies have looked at rodeo athletes, football players. At the NCAA level, while smoking is lower among athletes, smokeless tobacco is higher, particularly when you look at men's teams. So yeah, that continues to be something that's still going on to this day.
So I follow Tony Gwynn's career pretty closely, big baseball fan. He came up in the era when I was just getting into baseball. And, you know, one of the things you think of when you think of Tony Gwynn is, you know, always batting close to, you know, 350 kind of thing and being a prolific hitter, but also chewing tobacco. You know, you remember him always having a dip in his mouth. His actual Topps baseball cards had pictures of him with chewing tobacco. Those are actually exhibits in the complaint. Back in 91, he developed swelling on the right side of his neck for a tumor. He then developed a lesion in his lower right lip. 15 years later, his right neck swelled again. And then in 2010, he was found to have cancer in his right salivary gland. He died. He ultimately died in 2014. Sam, you're still, I mean, you're one of the, you know, most prominent baseball guys in the city. You cover baseball. You call, you know, you call baseball games. Your brother, I think, is a professional baseball player.
Yep.
You're around this sport more than, you know, most people who are listening. Is chewing tobacco still a popular thing among baseball players?
It's on the decline. And I think that, you know, a lot of the studies and the articles and the books that come out, and we read the article in the New York Times, they're aware how dangerous it is now. And I think, honest to God, what happened to Tony Gwynn is example number one, and players see what happened there. So I think they're, you know, they're coached early. It's more lectured to them by maybe even some coaches at those levels. If they see players doing it, they maybe may warn them. But I think certainly there are a lot more eyeballs open and a lot more people that are aware because of what happened to Tony Gwynn.
Doctor, do you agree? Do you see it on the decline?
Well, we're still crunching numbers here in California. We're, as a matter of fact, at a really challenging place right now across the tobacco research field. As smokeless tobacco has been about the same at the national level among all high schoolers for the last, say, 5 or 10 years. We see cigarettes going down, and we see these other products, electronic cigarettes and hookah, going up astronomically. So it's a very interesting time to try to project where things are going to be 5 years in the future.
Dr. Benjamin Chaffee, Assistant Professor, University of California, San Francisco School of Dentistry. And if you missed the piece in the New York Times, he's quoted in the piece, Tony Gwynn's family sues the tobacco industry, seeking recourse over fatal habit. Thank you for joining us here on Legal Face-Off.
Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks, Doctor. Hey, guys, let's pick up the discussion a little bit just for a couple minutes on the legal aspects of it. Jason, have you ever sued a tobacco company? I know you would like to. But
no, we have not. I mean, the tobacco litigation was really, in the 80s, was when it was really prominent and started by an attorney down in New Orleans. And, you know, it's pretty much been, the verdicts are all in. And it's pretty much been, you know, litigated to the hilt. So there's now a fund that's available for any of these claims, but I think it's pretty exhausted right now.
Well, you won't be surprised to have me tell you that I think these kind of lawsuits are sort of ridiculous, sort of frivolous. you know, there's no question that the tobacco industry, it's been proven that they were engaged in some deceptive practices, but, you know, on the other hand, there is obviously an element of personal responsibility. And to argue that Tony Gwynn did not know the dangers of something he was you know, so prominently engaged in for so many years, I think is a little tough.
I think the education really in the 80s probably is when the medicine and the education really kicked in. And I think, you know, from then forward, everyone knows that smokeless tobacco, cigarettes, all that's harmful. But, you know, prior to that, I mean, Philip Morris, all these companies, they encourage people to smoke. And if you look at the advertisement that they used to have in the 40s, 50s, I mean, smoking was in every advertisement and it was prominent. You know, there were successful businessmen and that's how you were a better person, by smoking cigarettes daily. So,
well, true enough. And to your point, the lawsuit that we're talking about by Tony Gwynn's family, you know, it has details of the landmark tobacco master settlement agreement from 88, which describes the graduation pleasure process that was designed to lure users to addiction, often with free samples, which is what they were doing with Tony Gwynn. So,
and your point about him being on the baseball card when you can see the dip in his
mouth. Yeah.
Yeah.
I do remember cards like that.
Well, and I'm sure that was
that's
before.
What he was known for.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was before the day of sponsorships like today. I mean, you know, if you want Peyton Manning to do that, it's $20 million. But, you know, Tony Gwynn, I'm sure he was encouraged or coached to keep that tobacco prominent.
You guys watch Mad Men? I'm just sort of getting through Mad Men now slowly. And I think I have lung cancer just from watching the amounts of smoking on that show. I don't know if it gets better or worse as the seasons progress, but. Man, those guys love their tobacco.
And, their martinis.
If you watch Shameless, I don't know if you guys watch Shameless.
Yeah. That's set in Chicago, right?
The whole family, even the kids are smoking cigarettes. So you just get
Do they have the youngest one smoking yet? I haven't caught up with the rest of the season yet.
I think the youngest one started at about 12.
Oh.
So you need to go find a pack after you watch a little Shameless. Yeah. Inside Out is next. We're halfway home on Legal Face-Off.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
And with that, we welcome you back to Legal Face-Off here from the Tribune Tower, WGN and WGN Plus. It's time for Inside Out with Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. And per usual, David Sussler and Tina Martini are with us. Tina is a partner and chair for the Chicago Intellectual Property Practice Group. And David, if I can flip through here and find his title, Associate General Counsel at National Material LP. You'd think I'd have those memorized by now, but nope, no chance. Welcome.
We got to get in Tina's firm, too. Don't forget Tina's firm.
Oh, DLA Piper.
Yes.
I do know that. You two have, you know, you have got the most, you know, elongated titles ever. But
well earned.
Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, guys. We're talking today about your latest column in Inside Out in Chicago Lawyer Magazine, June 2016. Client Crisis Management. The title is Crisis Management, but we want to know about client crisis. We don't ever see those, right? As lawyers, nothing ever goes wrong with our clients, and there's no crises. Yes? No?
Never. We never see those at all. That's why we decided to write on it.
Yes. You're dealing with one maybe now, or we deal with them almost every day. So tell us, Tina, what, first of all, is a client crisis? What does that mean?
Well, a client crisis is similar to a crisis for any other kind of organization, and that's a matter of great importance or significance that occurs for the client, and that could be anything, with respect to potentially impacting the livelihood of the organization. Usually there's a large amount of money at stake, and also there's usually some great urgency to it, requiring you to act pretty quickly, and oftentimes you have imperfect information in those circumstances, and they come in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes it's easy to spot them when they're happening. Other times, clients may not even realize that it's a crisis and they need the help of their attorneys and their outside counsel to tell them when something is a crisis.
And Tina, sometimes as an attorney, we're also a therapist, and I know I get phone calls where clients, I mean, it's a crisis to them, but as an attorney, you know, all right, you need to calm them down and deal with it. How do you do that when a client is, I don't want to say erratic, but when they're definitely worked up about an issue that you know, okay, we can work through this pretty easily?
His clients are erratic. DLA Piper clients are not erratic.
Oh, yes, they are. Every client can be erratic.
Everybody everywhere can be erratic. What I usually try to do, especially when I'm getting a signal that the client may be particularly upset about something and it's not apparent to the naked eye that, you know, what is going on, what I usually try to do is help them take a step back and ask them to explain it from the beginning. And what usually happens is you find that there is what's happening, and then there's the perception of what's happening by the client, and helping them just walk through it. Sometimes their reaction is an emotional one, and it's because they're worried about their job, or they're worried about who they're going to have to interface with, who they're going to have to answer to within their organization. And once you're able to deconstruct that, you're able to have a constructive conversation about, you know, how much of this is emotion versus how much of this is what's really happening, and then take, you know, and then take appropriate steps.
David, you are the inside part of Inside Out. From an inside perspective, inside counsel, how do you spot potential crises early and prevent them from being larger crises?
Well, that's a great question. And that's, you know, that's part of, I think, being as close to the business as possible. So I talk to our business leaders on a regular basis to learn, for example, well, what's going on? What are our plans? What are we doing there? We're gonna hire somebody, or I'll take a plant tour. And when I spot things, I keep my eye out for it. If I spot a potential issue that I know from my experience is a potential crisis brewing, I have a conversation with them. So that's the easiest way. If I know what their plans are, I can guide them away from doing something that's going to create a crisis.
David, in your call, go ahead.
In your column,
you talk about an existential crisis in your previous role in-house, in another in-house position. How did you deal with that? How did you know it was, you know, potentially existential, and how did you deal with that crisis?
That was a very interesting situation. We were a consulting company, and we had a number of employees who were on long-term contracts working at our client companies. And we got a call one day that from one of our employees telling us that the company he was working at told him he should leave our employment and go work for somebody else. So I sat down with the owner of the company, and we talked about what exactly that meant. And we realized pretty quickly that if they're talking to one, they're talking to them all. And that if we lost all of our employees to another company, we'd be out of business. So that was a pretty easy crisis to determine. And then we were in court the next day to get got a TRO granted, preventing them from cherry picking our employees, so that from that point on, we were able to negotiate a reasonable settlement. Now, that's a oversimplification, but that's in essence how that came to pass.
And then, Tina, can you share with us maybe an episode or a time where you had a story like that, where there was a crisis and you had to calm a client down?
Sure, absolutely. So I had a client, I do a lot of work in the life sciences branding space, and I had a client a number of years ago that was probably about 6 to 8 weeks from launching a pretty significant drug in their pipeline. And they had just heard back from the FDA that the FDA had rejected their first choice trademark and first choice brand. And they had been revolving a lot of their market strategy and materials around this particular brand. So I had to talk to the client about this because we're their branding council globally. And had to calm them down and explain to them. They said, well, we need to get another name in the next 5 days. And so after calming them down and just walking through the emotion of it, what we did was we very quickly, essentially on the fly, set up a strategy for working in tandem with their in-house marketing folks as well as their branding company to figure out a timeline within which we would vet, and what ended up being several hundred names within a week-long period. And we got them across the finish line. They really appreciated it. I mean, we were working probably 18-hour days to get them past this point. But it was the, what do we do about the crisis? And then there was the, how do you deal with the emotion behind it? And the client was very thankful, and it ended up being one of their most successful products over the last 10 years. That is a real-world example. And I'm dealing with another one this morning for another client, which is why I unfortunately couldn't make it into the studio this morning.
The column is Crisis Management from Chicago Lawyer Magazine, Inside Out. Column 67. Is there a party for 100? Are we doing something for the 100th column? Because we've got only about 33 left until you guys hit the three digits.
We're always up for a good party.
Yeah.
Well, you guys got to... Speaking of that, that's a good segue to the anniversary party for Legal Face Off coming up in June.
You guys are right.
You guys are among our many VIP guests of honor. Hope you can make it.
And we're looking forward to it.
Yes, and then to close out, we're going to talk about David's continued obsession with Bruce Springsteen. How many shows we got coming up, David? How many shows?
Not as many as you have, Rich. Uh-huh. Right now, I only have one coming up. August 28th.
I just hit my triple digits
so far.
I just hit 100. Yeah,
that's really impressive, Rich. Congrats.
It's impressive and scary, and the subject of several court orders. But we won't talk about that right now. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Happy holiday weekend.
As always, that's David Sussler, Associate General Counsel at National Material LP. Tina Martini, partner at DLA Piper and Chair, Chicago Intellectual Property Practice Group. The column, Crisis Management, ChicagoLawyerMagazine.com. Search for Inside Out. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, also on iTunes. Search for Legal Face Off. Rich Lenkov, Jason Whiteside. I'm Sam Panionovich. As we close
in that order, don't forget.
The show, yes, that's what
Rich,
I've been.
Rich and then Jason.
I've been told to read that forever.
Yeah, you can tell who has the ego, right? Uh-huh. It's not the
there's
plaintiff's attorney.
There's
right.
always
crazy.
A 20 tip to the back of the head. Legal Face Off on WGN+.
It's the Rich Lenkov show with guest host Jason yes. Whiteside every week.
I still get emails. Hey, can you tag my appearance on Bill and Wendy? You got it. You got it. As we
don't
tag
tell,
it, man. Tag
don't
it.
Tell Whiteside. I'm on
don't
another
tell
show.
Whiteside. I'm on like 2 a.m. in the middle of the night.
So, five topics today, and we'll start with the president getting sued, because why wouldn't we start there? Texas started to get the ball rolling, and now up to 11 states that are trying to sue President Obama.
Yeah, President Obama issued a directive and handed it down to schools earlier this month that said that transgender students should be able to use bathrooms and locker rooms that they that match their gender identity. So Texas and 10 other states have filed suit. Alabama, Wisconsin, West Virginia, Tennessee, Arizona, Maine, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Utah, and Georgia have all filed suit, basically stating that they don't want to abide by it. Essentially, Obama has issued these directives, and it's they're suing because, number one, it's not a legislative act. It's not been mandated by the federal government. It's essentially an executive order. Their claim is that the defendants, who is the Obama administration, have conspired to turn the workplace into a laboratory for a massive social experiment, flouting the democratic process and running roughshod over common sense policies. So they are concerned with what it might do, and so they filed a lawsuit to have the legislature actually enact the proper procedure for this.
Not the first time. Texas has sued the Obama administration like 20 times. The current governor,
really?
Yeah, the current governor is the former AG of that state, both Republicans. So there's
governor,
a lot of politics involved.
Yeah,
obviously.
I mean Governor Rick Perry too. He had actually authored a study when he was governor, trying to seek if they could secede from the union and if they could survive without federal funds.
How many of these lawsuits are actually successful when you try and sue a president?
Well, I mean, it's the administration, really. I mean, you're not. They might have named him individually. They commonly do that, but it's against
okay,
the administration.
Even more. That seems even tougher to do.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, a lot of this is politics. A lot of it ultimately will get decided by the Supreme Court anyway.
Just,
but this could be
really
the first step in you know, the Supreme Court dealing with this issue. Legally, what the interesting question is whether Title IX, which was designed to protect women in college, you know, in public colleges, whether that protects transgender people in this situation.
This is just really, it's a constitutional question. There's no money damages that the states are looking for. They're essentially just saying that the president's overstepped his bounds and they just want, you know, the directive to be revoked and to have the legislature actually do their job.
One of the first topics we covered on Legal Face-Off back in fall of, maybe even winter of 2014, the Bill Cosby sexual assault allegations. Well, time certainly flied on that one. About to stand trial for the sexual assault charges.
Where would we be without the cause, right? On Legal Face-Off, he's been the subject of so much good content. But yeah, earlier this week, a judge in Norristown, PA, found that there was enough evidence to actually go to trial on the one allegation by Andrea Constand, who's a former Temple University employee, alleging that Cosby drugged her and had sex with her against her will. That will be going to trial probably later this summer. Cosby's attorneys obviously have tried hard over the last several months to keep this case from going forward, but we will now have, for the first time, a criminal case going forward against Bill Cosby. Of course, this doesn't apply to the 50 or so other women that have made allegations, similar allegations, against Cosby, because those are barred by the statute of limitations.
It started in the 60s, in the mid-60s, the first
correct. That's,
right.
That's
accusation.
That's what these women allege. But the interesting question that, as you talked about Bill and Wendy, we covered this week, was whether these other allegations, whether these other women will make it into the criminal case, right? I mean, Jason and I deal with these kind of situations all the time when prior bad acts, prior acts of a defendant are being introduced or try to be introduced to prove the truth of the present case.
I think
Jason,
it's,
do you think
hard.
That these other women will get to testify?
I don't. I mean, it's just hearsay right now what these other women say, and there's no actual conviction against Bill Cosby. I think it'd be stronger evidence than the judge would be more likely to admit it if there was a conviction and you could show that it is a prior past act that would influence the current one. But there's no way, and even the witness in the preliminary hearing, the witness against this in this case against Bill Cosby, didn't come into court. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, Bill Cosby's attorney is just going to rip her to shreds on the stand, which is unfortunate if she's, you know, a victim of sexual abuse or assault from Bill Cosby. But it's tough. I mean, you see it all the time when they get on the stand and, you know, it's Bill Cosby's attorney's job to defend his client, and by default, the victim will be.
Yeah, I can't imagine any judge would allow mere allegations like you referenced to come in. There's been no convictions. It's just, you know, women alleging it, obviously in great detail, and we all think common sense dictates that it's probably true, but they probably won't come in. But the other interesting legal question is to what extent the jury will let these other allegations come into play when deciding his guilt or innocence on this one case. That's sort of the age-old question about a jury when you try to find 12 people who are impartial. The question isn't, you know, whether you could find 12 people who haven't heard about the Cosby situation, because everyone on earth has, but whether you can find 12 people who will put aside their preconceived notions of guilt or innocence and decide it based on the evidence in this case, who knows?
I mean, Rich and I have both tried cases, and you pull the jury afterward, and I mean, they bring their own experiences, their own common sense, their own knowledge to the decision, and, you know, they add the evidence to it too. And I mean, they might, 12 people might have 12 different, you know, responses or feelings on how they should decide. So,
Sam, you're on the Cosby jury. Any way you forget these 50 other women?
No,
only,
no way.
Only concentrate on the evidence in front of you?
It's hard to. I'd be clouded, for sure. Just being honest, I'd think about anything that happened. I mean, I looked at his Wikipedia page. Not that that's the end-all, be-all, but there's actually a page, and I have it up right here, titled Bill Cosby Sexual Assault Allegations. It has a table of contents. That's how big it is. So the research is there. All the claims are there, all the accusations are there. So it would be hard for me to sit up there and not think about everything that I've already heard that stems back to, you know, the Kennedy administration. So it's, yes, it would be tough. We move on to Tom Brady. I'm so sick of this story, Deflategate. Another appeal from the Patriots quarterback, who is now suspended for 4 games. At first it was 4, and then he was not suspended. Now he's suspended again. It's a gunfight between Roger Goodell and Robert Kraft, and now we have another appeal from Tom Brady.
Everyone loves a story about two rich white people duking it out in court. I mean, it's just, like you said, it's just been, you know, overplayed so many times. But now what the legal analysis is for what Tom Brady's trying to do is the decision, it was overturned by the appellate court, the decision to suspend him for four games. And it was just a panel. It was a 2-1 decision. So it was a 3-member panel. Now Tom Brady is asking for the full Second Circuit Court to rehear the case.
On bonk. Yeah. It's just a fun word to say, isn't it?
Yeah.
On bonk.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a good word. Which means the total panel or whole panel, which I believe is about 15 to 17 judges. But interestingly, only 1% of unbanked requests are actually granted. And if they deny that, then the last step is the U.S. Supreme Court, which has even less amount of cases that are accepted. So in all likelihood, it's probably, you know, there's a 1% chance that they'll actually rehear it. But I did read an article that Tom Brady is assembling physicists and chemists to test footballs and explain why in that temperature of the game against Indianapolis Colts, the balls were losing.
Are you
pounds
serious?
Per square foot.
Are you serious about this?
Yeah, seriously.
I mean, can you introduce new evidence at that point? I guess. I mean, if he's doing it, you would assume that you can. But it would seem weird that you could introduce new evidence at that level of appeal. But
yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how the labor law works with that. But yeah, that's what I read. Spending money on experts.
You know
prove.
What?
But
this interestingly, is? One of this is the NFL trying to be relevant in May. I mean, that's what this is. It's over and over again. It's we're not even in the training camp. And there's always something with the NFL.
Well, I mean, none of this is surprising. Listen, I mean, we knew he was probably going to appeal. I mean, it's like Jason referenced, it's a pretty last-ditch effort, except the difference in this case is the Chief Justice of the Circuit Court of Appeals wrote a pretty strong dissent in this case. So, and the other one last interesting thing is Brady hired Ted Olson for this level of appeal. Ted Olson is one of the most famous lawyers in the country.
Yeah, former
Solicitor General. Yeah. He won a small case you might have heard of called Bush versus Gore. So, big
guns.
His
wife was tragically killed in 9/11.
9/11, yep. What's next?
Drew Peterson already in prison, about to go maybe to prison a little bit longer.
Yeah, he's about to stay there.
Somebody snitched on him in the cell.
Good old Joliet. He's downstate in Marion Correctional Facility, and his cellmate recorded him trying to put a hit out on state's attorney, James Glasgow. So Drew Peterson, already convicted of killing his third wife, I believe. Still Stacey Peterson, the fourth wife, out there missing. Drew Peterson is confident he's going to get this appeal overturned, so he was worried that James Glasgow would try him for Stacey Peterson's disappearance. So they had a jailhouse snitch who wired up and recorded Drew Peterson allegedly talking in, not specifics, but in circles about putting a hit out on James Glasgow. So now he's going to be up for trial for that, as well as his appeal for the conviction of killing his third wife. So Drew Peterson, keep going.
Little break there.
Wiener circle last.
Yeah. And finally, an appeal was won. Remember, Wiener Circle destroyed the lawsuit about the hostile environment after a customer broke their arm. Looks like the appeal was won against the hot dog stand, which allowed for, I believe, a nice little payday, right?
Well, we've all been to the Wiener Circle at 2 a.m., and you know, part of the appeal for folks who are listening who haven't actually been to the Wiener Circle on the north side of Chicago, part of the appeal, in addition to the excellent char dogs and fries, is being yelled at by the employees.
Of course.
It's a good late night spot when you're you've maybe had a couple of drinks, and part of the sort of shtick of the restaurant is that you go there and the folks working behind the counter yell all sorts of insults at you. Well, this lawsuit by this woman who, as you mentioned, broke her elbow and wrist says that it went a little too far, that the insults created a hostile environment, that it intentionally creates and knowingly maintains a volatile environment in which the likelihood of injury is unreasonably high. And in this case, the allegation is that it led to an employee who threatened a customer with pepper spray, leading to the customer knocking the victim to the ground. So I guess the lesson is, you know, when you're at Wiener Circle, be aware of your surroundings.
Wear Kevlar. Get your SWAT uniform.
It's that kind of place.
You know, it's not. I mean, I've been there. If you're nice and polite, I mean, it is a little bit badgering, but it's not hostile.
Did you get a Trump dog yet at the Wiener Circle?
No, I didn't.
Did you see they put out little 3-inch Trump dogs? You haven't seen this?
Have not.
I got a picture right here. Look at that. It's like, oh yeah.
Looks
and,
good.
He didn't like that too much, but they call him Trump dogs. So we'll let you be the judge on what that stands for.
That might soon be a federal offense, that picture, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
When President Trump pulls back the onion. For Rich and Jason, I'm Sam. Thank you to all of our guests. Thanks to Inside Out. We will see you in 2 weeks here on WGN Plus.
And look for us on the WGN Hall of Fame legal face-off. Are we being inducted today?
We're going to try and jump on camera.
Are we not yet quite to that level?
Maybe next
Pretty
year.
Soon. If Brian Watercutt does his job.
Content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.